Let's take a minute to talk about Joe Bean Coffee, my go-to for great beans here in Rochester. I'm Chris Lindstrom, host of the Food About Town podcast and co-founder of Lunchador, and I regularly brew their coffee at home. A recent favorite of mine is the natural process Colombian Finca Buena Vista coffee from Edwin Zambrano. This coffee won a 2024 Good Food Award, and I can't help but agree with that assessment. My brews have been full with fruity flavors of pineapple, strawberry, and orange, and each cup has brightened my morning. Next time you need some beans, head over to Joe Bean's Roastery at 565 Blossom Road in Rochester, or shop online at joebeanroasters.com. For our loyal listeners, save 15% off your next order at joebeanroasters.com with code LUNCHADOR. You can also subscribe to Joe Bean's Perpetual Joy and receive freshly roasted beans on your schedule, and never be without great coffee again. Joe Bean is more than just coffee. It's a community, a commitment, and a cup full of care. Well, that music means it's time for another episode of Just Can't Not. I'm your host, Chris Lindstrom, and this is part of our preview for the Pittsburgh Fringe Festival. I know this is outside of the typical Rochester and surrounding area content, but the Fringe is universal, and we're thrilled to partner with the Pittsburgh team for their 13th year, running from March 19th to the 28th. To learn more about all of the shows and get tickets, go to pittsburghfringe.org. Tickets cap out at $20, and an entire event pass is only $150, so make sure to get your tickets today and join the action over on Penn Ave. And I'm here with a guest. Guest, why don't you introduce yourself?
I am Alan Irvin, the artistic director of Brawling Bard Theater. We have been with the Fringe since the very first year, so we are excited to be back.
Yeah, and I saw you have joined, you've joined Fringe in my city, Rochester, New York. So nice to talk to somebody who's visited my city, and I'm going to come visit Pittsburgh for the second weekend of Fringe this year.
All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to seeing you there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, now we're going to start talking about the Brawling Bard, but I got to say, there's not a lot of interviews I do where when I looked into all of the things you do, I'm like, one, there's no way I can keep this to half an hour, even though I have to keep it to half an hour. But like, I didn't know where to start, but let's just start with Brawling Bard. So one, what about Shakespeare brings out your pugilistic side, Alan?
Well, it kind of goes back to our beginning. I'm a big Shakespeare fan. And when we started the company, and it was also a friend of mine named Tanya Lynn. We put it together to do a show for the very first Fringe. We threw a proposal in and it got accepted, and we realized, oh, so I guess that means we need to write a show and put it together.
I love that's part of the culture of Fringe. Like, we're just going to say we're going to do a show and we're going to figure it out before it happens.
Yeah. And what it really came down to is Tanya is a stage combat person. In fact, that's what she does professionally now. She was just kind of starting out towards doing it professionally when we started. So part of the idea for that first show was also a place for her to do all the fight stuff that she didn't normally get to do in the small shows that brought her in. Mm. Kind of a place to really spread her wings and do some fun stuff. So part of the writing of that show as I was writing it was periodically to call her up and say, okay, so here's what I got so far. What other fights do you want in here? What else do you want to do? So that put the brawling in right from the beginning. And every show we've done since, that's been sort of part of it. If not fights, at least a lot of physical comedy and fight-like action.
Yeah, well, and I think that's also, you know, the diversity of different ways you can portray work that, you know, people have seen versions of, or, you know even single lines from, to provide, you know, different angles and different takes on it, I think is kind of the joy of being involved in that community of performing these classic works.
Yeah. Although the challenge is also to do as little as possible. The notes I often get when I'm writing a new show and starting to run it by the company is, that's too much Shakespeare. Right. Challenge is always cutting back on the Shakespeare. If I'm doing a show, particularly like this one, that is a single play, I'm usually working with the text. But yeah, we are not a Shakespeare company. We're a comedy and physical comedy bit that messes with Shakespeare. So it's getting that balance where there's enough of the Shakespeare for those who are the Shakespeare fans and want that. And but not so much it becomes a Shakespeare show, because a lot of people are coming for the comedy bit of it.
Well, and I think that it reminds me of other, you know, modern art forms in many ways. You know, as you know, like I'm a wrestling fan, for example, and like there's so many different angles. Like you can be the most technical, you can be a comedy wrestler, you can be all these different things, and they all live within the same, that same world of performing this genre of art form. And I think that's where, you know, in a modern context, you know, this, you know, using Shakespeare as a lens for performance in anything is completely valid, which is really cool.
Yeah, and that's, we want to have fun with it. And right, bringing shows usually that people are familiar with. Once or twice we've done a show specifically that nobody knows, just so that we can play with it and say, hey, here's this obscure thing that he did as well. But yeah, we're really looking at it as a jumping off place to do a lot of fun stuff and try out some ideas.
Well, and I love the concept of this one. So I'm gonna use the text at the beginning. So, you know, when basically the team has prepared for the wrong show and you're doing an unplanned, unrehearsed Midsummer's Night Dream, which just sounds like delightful chaos in the best possible way.
Yeah, that's what we're going for. That's a controlled chaos is a good description, particularly for this one. And yeah, coming up with some reason we're coming in. It was fun. This is one of the shows we did take up to Rochester about 10 years ago.
Awesome.
Which gave us a great reason to be running in with the wrong show. It's like, you know, we just arrived in Rochester last night. We went to the wrong place. We're just here. And right from the beginning, you're starting to set up sort of the chaos that's going to come.
Yeah. And didn't mention the venue. So the venue for this is Metta Healing Arts Community. It's a yoga studio, and you're performing 5 shows there, 2 on the 21st at 2 and 4, 1 on the 27th at 8, and then 2 on the 28th at 3 and 7. And tickets are $15 at PittsburghFringe.org. What about this venue, interested you when you were planning this one?
When it came about, this is a new venue for us. We'd used another one for a couple of years, and we're looking at that, but also just putting out, maybe we want to move to another place. And it was actually the response from the venue. They came back really excited and saying, oh yeah, we love the idea for the show. I think it would fit in really nice here. And so that was kind of the hook that, oh yeah, I want to go someplace that's excited. Also, it's one that has been a venue for the Fringe for a number of years and has other shows in. So being in a space where there's kind of a community of performers and other people coming in, whereas the space we'd used for the last year or two, we were the only show in there, which also had its advantages. But in the past, we've been places where, yeah, we're one of 2 or 3 shows, and that's kind of fun, and being right in the heart of the Fringe's footprint, that was kind of neat. And then playing with the venue, once I got there and sort of looked around, there's stuff in the neighborhood, like right across the street, that started to build in quick. That's, I won't mention what, don't want to ruin some surprises there, but it's like looking around and say, oh, we can reference that, so we can make use of this. So
yeah,
that's always fun.
No, it's very cool. So when, is, somebody who's done a lot of obviously writing and working with the company and looking at, performing through the lens of Shakespeare, is that something you enjoyed when you were younger? Is that something you came into later in life? How would you describe your relationship with the works in general?
I've always enjoyed Shakespeare. And I remember even back in high school and possibly even earlier, just loved the plays in of themselves. And doing little bits and pieces, sometimes like a talent show or something, I'd pull out a speech to perform. It wasn't something, I didn't come in, go into theater or even ever think about writing a play. I got into theater later. My main performing background is actually as a storyteller. And I've performed both at Pittsburgh and Rochester doing storytelling shows. But I've always loved theater as well as Shakespeare specific. And as I said, we were sort of kicking around ideas. And when the idea got accepted, it was not only, oh, now we need to put the show together. It was, oh, that means somebody needs to write it. And I guess the somebody is me. So yeah. That's how I became a playwright.
I mean, what better time than then? And actually, you brought one of the things I was, you know, interested in talking about is storytelling as an art form. You know, I'm somebody who is recorded very often. I do a lot of interviews. I've done the, you know, on stage storytelling only once. It was part of our, you know, local newspaper was doing that. And it's such a different experience of formulating and practicing and working through a story and, you know, working on the beats and all those things. It's less of the read and react part of interviews that I love so much, but there's something very special about when you hear a story that grabs you on stage in that specific way. When did you start doing storytelling and what about it was really appealing to you?
I started back when I was in college and I worked at summer camps as a camp counselor and just started telling stories in the cabin after lights out, mostly to kind of fill the time. I knew a couple of ghost stories, a couple of old Irish folk tales, at least well enough to kind of improvise my way through. And it was a way of kind of connecting, both settling the kids down, but also, you know, building a rapport with the guys in the cabin.
Yeah.
So that was my start. About three summers during the school year, I'd learn one or two new stories. So I'd have something new to bring in. And we do stuff around bonfires and things like that. And then just kind of went from there, starting to learn other stories. When I moved up to here to Pittsburgh, that's when I encountered other storytellers and started to be able to learn the craft of it and take workshops. And we had local weekend conferences, workshops and things. So the place where I could go and just refine my understanding of the art a bit more.
Yeah. And I find it interesting because, you know, my awareness of it as a, you know, as a art form came from, and I'm going to use a term and you please correct me if I'm wrong, because you're way more involved in the community than I am. But to me, when I became familiar was, I'm going to use the term resurgence, you know, in the late aughts when I started, you know, listening to the Moth podcast, listening to, when I heard it on This American Life first was, you know, people telling stories from, you know, that were from the Moth. And then I picked up from it from there during, you know, earlier in the run. And there was something about it that felt very authentic. And there were people on, you know, This American Life that were, you know, solo storytellers or monologuers or different, you know, that's they just did audio journals or whatever. And they all lived in this world of somebody with this experience or somebody who's lived something got to tell it in this fascinating way. What was the community like when you joined it? Because for me, that seemed very fully formed, you know, in the, you know, late aughts. Mm-hmm. How did you get into it? And what was the community like then?
So I came in, kind of in the 80s and 90s. And so our modern resurgence starts really kind of 60s and 70s. Coming out of the whole resurgence of folk arts. Some of it centered here in Pittsburgh. There was at the University of Pittsburgh Library School, there was an instructor there who really put forth this idea that storytelling is something that particularly children's librarians should be doing. Mm. Been a kind of resurgence of that, like in the 20s and 30s, and she was bringing that back. So she had a popular storytelling course and how to do it for librarians. And a number of those people stayed around here in Pittsburgh. So there was a fully formed community that had grown out of that. And at that point, the emphasis was very much on traditional folk tales, legends, things like that. So that's where I kind of came in on this. At the same time, we're getting a national resurgence. It was not just here in Pittsburgh, and people branching out into other types of stories. And a fellow named Donald Davis, who is still around and performing, I think, really pioneered the idea of the personal story, the sort of memoir that eventually things like The Moth does pick up. So The Moth and This American Life and those things come in kind of a second wave, next generation of people. And to some extent, kind of reinventing what was already going on, because they weren't quite aware of that until it was up and running, and then started to make these connections between these two different movements.
It kind of had to be interesting to have seen it from then and then saw that, you know, either, you know, that change in direction or that visibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, you know, sometimes there can be the attitude of, oh, you know, now that this is popular, now that it's mainstream, it's not the same. It's not what it was. How did that grab you when you were, you know, living through that as being part of that community?
Well, it was interesting because, again, with The Moth and those types of shows, of course, the focus was very much just on the personal story.
Yeah.
And so part of the connections would be to also introduce people into, oh, there is all this other world. The Moth, yeah, made a lot of people like you kind of aware that, oh, storytelling exists.
Yeah.
And then some of the challenge was, okay, and that's really good, but here's these other things as well. In that same period, we were just starting up a local storytelling festival here in Pittsburgh that ran for about 10 years. And so that was one of the connections to try and make connections into the Moth audience and even bring some of the local Moth people to the festival, which I think we did manage to do that a couple of times, kind of towards the end of the run.
Yeah.
And so bring their audience in and then maybe bring some of us to them and the connections. It was this nice little kind of cross-fertilization because we were doing different stuff, but very complementary stuff.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, a lot of the things that you do surround storytelling in so many different forms, whether it be, you know, historical, you know, doing recordings and also doing tours, which is, you know, both environmental and engaging with your surroundings and engaging with history. It seems like that's kind of like a perfect confluence of all the things that you're passionate about.
Yeah. So the tours, yeah, are walking tours here in Pittsburgh. And that is very much when I'm coming in, I bring those sort of skills. I do a lot of stories. And one of the tours I do is a ghost story tour. And that does have bits where, okay, we're going to just stop here in this place for 10, 15 minutes so I can give you the full story, not just throw some facts at you.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, as you say, it's fun because then we're in the space. It's like, oh, this happened right over there. And soak up the ambiance of the place and kind of play off of that. But yeah, the tour guide stuff draws a lot on the storytelling skills.
Well, and I think that's the other thing is you don't know the audience you're going to have that day. And I'm sure it, you know, it allows you to stretch with sometimes you are improvising and bringing stuff in because they want to learn about something. They ask a question. And I always love that side of interviewing, that side of, you know, talking to somebody is you don't know where the conversation's going to go. You might have a plan, but, you know, as Mike Tyson always says, you always have a plan until you get punched in the face, which ties back to the Shakespeare show. But, you know, there's, you don't know where you're going to go, even though you have a plan to start with.
Yeah, and with the tour, there's kind of this structure to always kind of bring me back. But yeah, and the punch in the face for that is often somebody asking a question that nobody's asked before, or say, oh, what's that building over there that I don't usually mention? And then we're off and kind of running with that.
Yeah, and I love that, you know, those live pivots. I think that's the joy sometimes, but it also forces you to know more than what you planned, or, you know more about the place you're around. And you might tell 10% of what you're passing, but you know, 60%. And that's so, those are those delightful moments where you can be that for somebody by doing the work and by being passionate about something.
Absolutely. And a nice illustration of that is I did a tour with just a couple who are in town visiting, and the told me as we were talking that usually they go into some place and they got the phones and they're doing the Google, what's that building, learning about it, and they enjoy that. But I think they were working with a travel agent that suggested the tour. And the really neat thing and the reward for me at the end, we finished the tour and the guy said, you know what? We're always booking a tour after this, wherever we go. So, oh yeah, we've learned so much more than we ever would have just walking around with Google on our phones.
Yeah.
That's what we're hoping for.
Yeah. So I got a couple more questions before we close out. So one, like, you came to Pittsburgh and you stayed. What is it about? What is it about the city that kept you there versus going on to another place? What is it about Pittsburgh that is part of you now?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it was the storytelling, because I was starting to do a lot of that by that point. It is the history. We have a lot of history going back to French and Indian War and beyond. And it's not all just steel, although that's a piece of it I've been getting into a lot in the last couple of years. But as the culture is a lot of theater and a lot of performing. One of the challenges the Fringe has is that there is so much other theater going on in Pittsburgh that it's kind of hard to break through and sometimes catch the attention for this particular type. Mm. So just the whole cultural mix, and it's a beautiful place, which often surprises people who haven't been here. And because everyone's idea is Pittsburgh is 1950s steel mills and smog, and people are surprised to see, oh, that is long gone. And our rivers and our hills and just the cultural variety in our neighborhoods. And yeah, I could go on and give you a whole 2-hour tour of that, but
I kind of figured you could. So we got 5 minutes left. So I want you to tell me just some great things about the rest of the cast, about, you know, the whole, you know, the people in the troupe. And then I want to finish off with, tell me one place to go eat in Pittsburgh when I come to visit. I'm always learning about that. That's how I dive into everything. So first tell me about the cast, and then tell me a place I should go to eat when I come to town.
All right. Well, the cast is one of the things I like to talk about, because that's one of the fun things about Brawling Bard is we are kind of an established troupe. So it is a core group of performers, one of whom does go back to the very first show. Many have been for numbers of shows. And that is great for me as a playwright, because as people perform, you kind of develop a sense for their voice and their rhythms. And so I can write for particular people, knowing that this guy's going to be able to handle this. Michael Makita kind of came in on the first show and has been with us ever since. And so he is great on this. Anne Ramat is our fight coordinator now. When Tanya left, Anne's actually one of her students. And so Tanya gave her a blessing for Anne to come in. And Anne's kind of fun because she started with us on the fourth show, and that's where she actually got a taste of stage combat, is coming in. And as we were early in rehearsals, and I could see on her face, I'd worked with her on a couple of shows, and that's why I brought her in, and could see her say, what did I get myself into? And at this point, my daughter, who was in high school, and has gone on to do stage combats. She was part of the company. And so it was just like, okay, Elizabeth, would you take Anne over and teach her how to get punched? And that's what got Anne started. And I say that's one thing she does professionally as well. And so having her go from performer, first kind of nervous on this, to really being my collaborator and let's design fights and stuff together is really great.
Well, that has to be super rewarding too.
Absolutely. And another thing that's fun about ongoing troupe and working with the community is people also learn the process and learn that absolutely it's fine to sort of jump in and say, wait, this isn't working, or well, that joke's not really good, or wait, can we change this because the fight needs to go this way or that. And the company's learned that, yeah, they can do all of that. They've also learned, as something Michael warns any new cast member about, to be careful what you say when we're joking around in rehearsal, because anything you say in rehearsal might end up in the show. And in fact, that happened. There's a bit where we're assigning parts in this one, and Alex Makita gets assigned Titania, and then Michael gets assigned Nick Bottom. And as you may guess, since they're both Makita, they are related. It's father, daughter. And in our first sort of read through, and we were talking about this, she said, okay, but do not make me Titania, because I do not want to do a love scene with my father. I was like, which we all agreed, yeah, that would not work. But it was like, oh, that is such a fun thing to play with. That is how the parts originally get assigned in our first panic, until she objects and say, no, I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, we got to change this. So so being able to build those things in is fun. Andy Cole, this is, I think, his fourth or fifth show with us. And he's become sort of one of the core people. And Andy is just kind of game for anything. And we sometimes have to ratchet down some of his enthusiasm. Like, Andy, when I push you, don't go flying across the stage. Just giving you a little push. So, and then we're always bringing in new people as well. And Gwen Norsick, the last member of the cast, she is new this year. And she is coming in for a role that actually was originally written for Tanya Lynn when she was here. And it's a bit of a smaller role. It's sort of off to the sides, which is then an easy role to bring someone in, and particularly because she has more conflicts in her rehearsal schedule, which was the case with Tanya, who had the original part. So the part is written for, you've got less blocking, so it's okay if you can't, you know, if you've got, she can't make like our weekend rehearsals. So it's okay. Because half the scenes you're sitting over there just handing people random stuff. So
I love that. And I just want to finish off with, if I'm going to one place in Pittsburgh, what's the place I should go?
Oh, and that is such a hard question. I've been running that mind. Well, the place that everyone goes, and it's the place that comes up if you Google places to eat in Pittsburgh, is Primanti's.
Of course.
I think there is a city ordinance that every visitor has to eat at Primanti's.
Yeah.
It's famous for the sandwiches that have everything on them. And by everything, I mean not just your sandwich fixings, but your coleslaw and your French fries. And the story is, these were originally designed, the original Primanti's is in a neighborhood that was originally the produce district. And so guys would be coming in, this is 30s and 40s, bringing in trucks from the farms at 3 a.m., having to sit there with the truck, and it was mealtime for them. So the sandwich was designed, you can have the whole meal in your hand here and eating while you're sitting waiting for them to unload your truck. Or at least that's the most famous story about the Primanti sandwich.
Every town has their most famous thing with an apocryphal story. It's kind of the... It's one of the joys of learning about food, because you end up learning about history and you learn that every town has it and every story is almost definitely fake that are the origins for those things. But that's part of storytelling, and part of performing. Mm-hmm. So make sure to go grab your tickets for Brawling Bard Theater over at the Meta Healing Arts Community. Shows on March 21st, the 27th, and the 28th. Go to PittsburghFringe.org to get your tickets. Anything else before we close out, Alan?
I think that pretty much covers it. It's going to be a really fun show. So, and come prepared to possibly get pulled into it one way or another.
Well, that's part of Fringe, getting invested, enjoying the thing. So thank you so much for joining this episode of Just Can't Not. If you happen to come up to Rochester, just want to listen to some other great shows on the network, go to lunchador.org, and we'll see you out on the Fringe.
This has been a presentation of the Lunchador Podcast Network.
En garde.
Hey, this is Paulie Guglielmo, and if you'd like to hear the behind-the-scenes stories of some of your favorite small businesses in Rochester, join me for one-on-one interviews with the entrepreneurs behind those businesses. It's the Paulie Guglielmo Show podcast, and it comes out every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. right here on the Lunchador Podcast Network.
Hello, hello, folks. My name is Magnus. I am a host of The Mind of Magnus. It's a podcast where I focus on expanding my brain and bringing some awesome people along the way to help expand your brain. So I have some new seasons and some awesome new guests coming up this year. So join me. Send me some factoids if you have your own. I even have a call-in line. So check it out. Find me at mindofmagnus.com, wherever you get your Lunchador Podcast Network, which is everywhere.